I want you to do something for a second. And I mean, really, don't just, listen passively.
Yeah, actually play along with us here.
Right. So wherever you are right now, whether you're sitting in traffic, taking a walk, maybe just lounging on your couch, just look around.
Seriously, take a deliberate look at the physical environment surrounding you.
Yeah, look at the objects. Maybe it's the dashboard of your car or the coffee mug sitting next to your laptop. Notice the fabric of your jacket.
And pay attention to the space, too.
Exactly, the space between you and the nearest wall, that invisible gap that you could physically walk across. And as you're doing this, try to feel the passage of time.
Just sense it ticking away.
Second by second, moving inexorably forward as you listen to the sound of my voice.
It feels incredibly solid, doesn't it? Mm. Concrete, undeniable. I mean, it's the absolute baseline of our daily existence.
It is the baseline. We don't even question it. The mug is a thing. The space is a container holding the thing. Time is the invisible track the container moves along. But, and this is a massive, but what if we told you that every single one of those concepts,
everything you just looked at,
everything, the distinct objects, the empty space containing them, the very passage of time you are currently experiencing, what if all of that is actually the result of a massive civilization-spanning grammatical error?
I know. It sounds absurd when you say it out loud.
It sounds like a joke.
It does. It sounds like a linguistic joke or maybe a late-night dorm room philosophy debate after way too much coffee.
Oh, definitely.
But the material we are diving into today argues with rigorous mathematical and physical backing that this assumption is arguably the most consequential blind spot in the entire history of human thought.
And that is exactly what we are getting into today. We are doing a deep dive into a truly revolutionary paper. It's called Healing the Platonic Rift, authored by David Noel Lynch.
And it acts as a methodological companion, kind of like a decoder ring.
Right, a decoder ring for a much larger, denser framework known as the Noelian Treatise.
Which is quite the undertaking to read, let me tell you.
Oh, absolutely. And let me set the stakes for you right now, because our mission today isn't just to learn some new esoteric, fringe theory of quantum mechanics so you can sound smart at a dinner party.
No, we have a much bigger goal.
We do. We are going to attempt to completely, permanently uninstall your default operating system for reality.
Which, frankly, is an upgrade we desperately need.
Yeah.
Yeah, because modern physics, if we are being completely honest with ourselves and looking at the actual state of the field, is in a state of profound crisis.
Crisis might even be an understatement.
True. And I don't mean minor anomalies here and there. I mean foundational cracks in the bedrock.
Right, like the big stuff.
The huge stuff. We have singularities like the center of a black hole or the Big Bang, where our absolute best mathematical models just throw up their hands and break down into infinity.
They just spit out error codes, basically.
Exactly. And then we have dark energy, which supposedly makes up nearly 70% of the universe, and we have absolutely no clue what it actually is.
None at all.
And we have the hard problem of consciousness, where we can't figure out how inert, dead matter suddenly wakes up and has an internal experience.
And the standard approach from the scientific establishment is usually just to say, well, our measurements just aren't good enough yet.
Right. They just want better rulers.
Exactly. They say, we just need a bigger particle accelerator. We need to put another more expensive telescope in orbit. We just need more data to fill in the gaps.
The assumption is always that the map is correct. We just haven't drawn in all the local roads yet.
Yeah. But this source material, the Noelian universe theory, which we'll be referring to as KUT, it argues something fundamentally different.
And far more radical.
Way more radical. It argues that these crises aren't failures of measurement. They aren't gaps in our data at all.
They're failures of language.
Yes. The crises in physics are symptoms of the fact that we are using the wrong grammar to describe the cosmos. So we are going to explore how the universe isn't a collection of things at all. It is an ongoing, relentless, incredibly complex performance.
It's an active event.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the cure they're proposing, we first have to really diagnose the disease.
We can't just skip to the end.
Right. And our source text gives this disease a very specific, memorable name. It calls it the Platonic Pathogen.
The Platonic Pathogen.
Yeah. And it defines it exactly as this. The catastrophic confusion of a mathematical map with the physical territory.
It's a brilliant, highly critical framing, because to understand what Lynch means by this pathogen, we have to look closely at the actual tools that theoretical physicists use to build their models of reality.
Okay, laid out for us.
Well, they use things like Riemannian manifolds to describe curved space-time. They use Cantorian set theory. They use the continuous real number line.
Hold on, let's ground that a bit. Because when you say Riemannian manifolds and Cantorian set
A
theory,
bit of a mouthful, I know.
yeah, for those of us who didn't get our PhDs in differential geometry, we're essentially talking about the highly abstract math used to calculate curves, infinite spaces, and like multidimensional shapes, right?
Broadly speaking, yes. They are magnificent intellectual achievements, truly. They're internally consistent, perfectly logical mathematical structures.
Okay.
But, and this is the crux of the pathogen, the place where the infection actually starts, these tools are completely static.
Meaning they don't move.
Right. They are finished. They exist eternally in a state of conceptual completion.
So they're frozen.
Exactly. A mathematical circle doesn't have to be drawn. It just conceptually
It's
is.
like a blueprint.
Right.
Once the blueprint is printed, it doesn't change.
It's a fantastic blueprint. But then a physicist takes these static, completed, eternally perfect tools and tries to use them to describe a black hole tearing apart a star.
Which is very messy.
Very messy. Or the explosive birth of the universe, or the collapsing wave function of a quantum state.
None of which are static.
Right, these aren't static things at all. These are dynamic, thermodynamically active, violently evolving physical processes.
There's a quote from the source text that I absolutely love for this.
The river quote.
Yes. It has this beautiful, almost poetic quote to describe this error. It says that standard physics is describing a river with the vocabulary of architecture.
It is so evocative.
Describing a river with the vocabulary of architecture.
Yeah.
Because if you try to describe the swirling, chaotic, rushing movement of a river using only terms meant for solid buildings like walls, foundations, load-bearing beams, drywall, WOM, you are going to end up with absolute nonsense.
You'd sound crazy.
You would. You're going to have to freeze the river in your mind to make your tools work. You'll say, well, this column of water is the pillar, and this sheet of ice is the roof. You've completely lost the essence of the river, which is its flow.
And that freezing process, that insistence on turning a flow into a structure, is exactly where the foundational errors of modern physics creep in.
It's force.
It is. What's tragic is that the mathematical tools themselves actually confess their own limitations, but we completely misread the confession.
How so?
Let's look at what the text calls the reification of limits.
Okay, reification, meaning making something abstract into a concrete physical thing.
Exactly. This is where the math really plays a trick on our cognition. In rigorous mathematics, there's a vital concept called an asymptotic limit.
Okay.
Let me give you a classic example that Lynch uses, the Alexandrov one-point compactification.
Okay, my brain just threw an error code.
I saw you wince.
Yeah, walk us through that slowly.
It sounds intimidating, but it's actually quite simple to visualize. Imagine an infinite straight line.
Okay, got it.
Just a line stretching forever to your left and forever to your right.
Sure.
The mathematician comes along and says, I want to do some specific topological calculations, and it would be much easier if I could treat this infinite line like a closed loop, like a circle.
Okay, so they want to bend it.
Right. So the mathematician says, I'm going to imagine a single abstract point infinitely far away, way out at the ends of reality, where the left end of the line and the right end of the line finally meet up.
That's convenient.
They call this the point at infinity. Now, any good mathematician knows this point isn't real.
Because you can't actually get to infinity.
Exactly. It's a bookkeeping device. It's a horizon drawn on the map so they can execute certain types of theorems. It's an asymptotic approach. It's a directional movement toward a boundary that you can never actually reach.
So it's a verb. It's the act of tending towards something indefinitely. It's a process of approaching, not a destination you could buy a ticket to.
It is entirely verb. It's a behavioral rule for the numbers. But orthodox physics, infected by this Platonic pathogen we're talking about, commits a massive discipline-wide error here.
They forget it's a verb.
They do. It takes that abstract horizon on the mathematical map and treats it as a solid brick wall in the physical territory.
Oh, wow.
Let's look at the biggest example, the Big Bang. When a cosmologist winds the expansion of the universe backward in time, they see the galaxies getting closer and closer together.
Shrinking the universe down.
Right. The density of the universe goes up and the volume goes down. In the math, the density approaches infinity and the volume approaches zero.
Approaching as a limit.
Exactly. These are limits in the calculus sense, a trajectory. But orthodox cosmology treats that mathematical limit as a physical arrival.
They treat it as a destination.
Yes. They declare, a physical point of literally zero volume and literally infinite density actually existed at time equals zero.
What's fascinating here is how deeply language dictates what is literally unthinkable to a scientist.
It limits them completely.
The mathematician says, infinity is a direction we can point toward to see how equations behave. The physicist gets confused by the grammar and says, I have pointed toward infinity, therefore infinity is a geographical place I can physically visit.
They build a whole model around a place that doesn't exist.
We've taken a process, an approach, and solidified it into an object. We turned a verb into a noun.
Which brings the whole system crashing down.
But wait, let me push back on this, because this sounds like we're just playing word games with standard cosmology.
It's more than word games.
Well, let's test it. When a cosmologist winds the clock back to the Big Bang and hits infinite density and zero volume, you're saying they're basically doing the math equivalent of dividing by zero on a cheap desk calculator, getting that error message on the screen, and then writing a peer-reviewed paper pretending that the error message is a physical, geographical location where the universe started.
That is precisely the devastating critique the source is making. Division by zero is undefined in mathematics. It breaks the rules.
The calculator literally says you can't do it.
Exactly. But instead of saying, ah, our equations are no longer valid here, we need a new framework, physicists historically said, this broken math must represent a physical reality called a singularity.
It's like looking at a physical roadmap, and you're driving along and you see the little icon on the map for bridge out ahead.
Okay, I like this.
And instead of understanding that as a warning about the physical condition of the road telling you to stop your car, you press the gas pedal down, drive your car at 100 miles an hour straight into the ravine because you thought the little warning symbol on the paper map was a physical ramp you could jump off of.
That analogy is absolutely spot on. We have mistaken the warning label of our mathematical tools for the structural reality of the cosmos.
We jumped the car into the ravine.
We did. And this brings us to the deepest, most insidious consequence of the Platonic pathogen. It's not just that our math is sometimes misapplied.
It goes deeper.
Much deeper. It is a fundamental grammatical problem in how human beings process reality. Our language, our very sentence structure, forces us to think of reality as an assembly of nouns.
Things.
Yes. Particles are nouns. Space is a noun. Time is a noun. When we look at the universe, our default question is, what is the universe made of? We are always looking for the smallest irreducible noun, the ultimate building block, the atom of being.
But K2, the Moelian universe theory, says that trying to find the ultimate noun is a fool's errand. It's the wrong question entirely.
Because a science that thinks in verbs asks an entirely different question.
Right.
It completely discards what is the universe made of and instead asks, how does the universe happen?
How did it happen?
The universe isn't a collection of things sitting in a box. It is an ongoing performance. It is an act of continuous becoming.
Becoming, right.
And Lynch argues that if we don't fix this grammatical error, if we keep trying to stuff dynamic, fluid verbs into static, rigid noun drawers, we are going to stay stuck in this physics crisis forever.
We'll never get out of the ravine.
Never. We will just keep inventing invisible nouns like dark matter and dark energy to balance our broken equations.
Okay, so if the Big Bang singularity, this foundational concept of modern science, is just a mathematical hallucination caused by a grammatical error, what other massive pillars of modern physics are just symptoms of this noun grammar disease?
Pretty much all of them.
Really? Because if we're tearing down the Big Bang, we might as well keep the wrecking ball swinging. I want to know what else falls apart.
Oh, the wrecking ball takes out the entire block.
Let's do it.
Because once you put on these Noelian lenses, once you start seeing the verbs, you realize that the singularity is just the most obvious hallucination. Let's look deeper into why that dimensionless point of the Big Bang isn't just weird math, but a physical impossibility.
Okay.
The text points out a very elementary, undeniable logical demand. Anything that is supposedly the physical origin of our universe must itself be able to sustain a causal history.
Meaning it has to be able to cause the next thing.
Exactly. It must be capable of physically existing to cause the next thing to happen. And to physically exist in our universe, you have to possess extent.
You have to take up space.
You must have volume.
Right. I mean, that seems like common sense. Yeah. If you have zero volume, you literally do not take up space.
Right.
And if you take up no space, you don't exist in the physical realm. You might be a concept, like the number three, but you aren't a physical object.
The text lays out the arithmetic brilliantly to show the absurdity. Density equals mass divided by volume. That's high school physics.
Sure.
If volume is truly zero, your density isn't a massive heavy infinity. It is mathematically undefined. It is garbage output.
The calculator says error again.
Exactly. A particle or a singularity with absolute zero volume has a zero cross-section for interaction. It can't overlap with anything. It can't bump into anything.
It can't cause anything.
It can't cause anything. The singularity, by its own internal logic and math, is causally inert. It is a mathematical ghost that we have inexplicably elevated to the status of a physical origin.
But wait, we have the cosmic microwave background radiation.
We do.
We could look up into the sky and literally see the afterglow of a universe that was incredibly hot, incredibly dense, and expanding rapidly. Hmm. KUT can't just wave away the observational data.
It doesn't.
So how does it get rid of the singularity without ignoring the astronomy?
By establishing that absolute zero volume ceases to be a physically available state in reality, KUT doesn't deny that the early universe was astonishingly hot and dense. It agrees with the observational data.
Okay.
What it denies is the mathematical extrapolation to zero. In KUT, the most compressed possible configuration of the cosmos isn't a dimensionless point. It is a single fundamental operational unit called an event point.
An event point?
Yes. This event point contains the maximum possible finite energy. It is bounded. It has a specific physical footprint. It is physically tractable.
So it's not a ghost?
No, it's real. The Big Bang, therefore, wasn't an explosion out of a mathematical nothingness. It was simply the rendering of the first finite event points. Reality has a pixel size, and you can't zoom in past the pixel.
Okay, so that's the hallucination of the singularity completely torn down.
Mm-hmm.
But the source text goes after an even bigger, much more deeply ingrained target next.
It does.
It goes after the container model of space. Mm-hmm. And I have to warn you, this is the one that really started to mess with my head when I was reading the source material.
It is incredibly disorienting because the concept of space as a container is an assumption so deeply built into our cognitive scaffolding that we don't even know we're making it.
It's just intuitive.
From the moment we are babies dropping blocks into a bucket, we learn this. Orthodox physics, from Newton to Einstein, fundamentally treats space as a pre-existing neutral medium.
The bucket.
Right. It's the stage, and matter and energy are the actors moving around on it. Even in Einstein's relativity, where the stage can bend and warp, the stage is still just there, waiting for the drama to unfold.
Right. We picture the universe as a giant empty theater. Maybe the floorboards creak and warp under the weight of the actors, which is gravity, but it's still the theater.
Yes. But in the Noellian framework, this entire paradigm is completely inverted. Space is not a pre-existing container. Space is ash.
Ash, like the gray dust left over from a campfire.
The exact same concept.
Yeah.
In KUT, reality is driven by a perpetual dialectical cycle called the Abraxian engine.
The Abraxian engine.
It's the literal engine of reality. It's the process where pure chaotic potentiality meets a rendering field, and actual physical locked-in reality is precipitated into existence.
So it's turning maybe into definitely.
Precisely. And every single time one of those event points we just talked about is rendered, it leaves behind a structural residue, a permanent geometric imprint in what KT calls the CRAM.
The CRAM, K-R-A-M. We're going to be using that term a lot. What does it stand for?
It stands for the Noellian Resonant Attractor Manifold.
Okay, that's a lot of syllables.
It is. But simply put, it is the higher dimensional geometric memory substrate of the cosmos. And here is the paradigm-shattering, brain-bending part. This structural residue, this ash, isn't stored in space.
It doesn't fill up an existing room.
It is space. What we observe, what we measure with our rulers, what we experience as spatial distance is literally the accumulated geometric sedimentation of rendering events that have already occurred.
Let me make sure I'm really getting this, because it feels like trying to read a book upside down.
Take your time.
If I'm understanding, this space isn't an empty theater waiting for the actors to arrive. It's the literal footprints left on the floor after the dance has already happened. The dance creates the floor by happening.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. Space is what remains after the fire of rendering has passed through a particular coordinate. It is the thermodynamic exhaust of the universe's ongoing computational performance.
Exhaust.
Yes. When we look at a vacuum, we aren't looking at an empty container. We are looking at the quietest possible expression of the universe's metabolism. We are looking at cold ash.
But wait, how does that work practically? If space is exhaust, how can I wave my hand through the air right now? Doesn't the exhaust block me?
Your hand isn't moving through the ash like a physical object pushing through dust.
It's not.
No, your hand is a localized concentration of rendering events. As your hand moves, It is actually a pattern of rendering shifting its locus of activity across the CRAM, laying down new ash as it updates its position. Movement is just the sequential updating of the rendering process.
That completely flips causality on its head.
It does.
Because in the standard model, space exists first, and events happen inside it. In KUT, events happen first, and space is what they leave behind as a consequence.
And if we carry this logic forward, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it provides a shockingly elegant solution to one of the greatest embarrassments in modern cosmology: dark energy.
Oh, wow. Okay, I was wondering when we'd get to the dark stuff. Explain this. Because dark energy, as I understand it from standard science documentaries, is supposedly this deeply mysterious, invisible, undetectable force that is somehow pushing the universe apart.
Making it expand faster and faster.
Yeah. And physicists just shrug and say, we don't know what it is, but the math says it's there.
They call it a placeholder term for our ignorance. But if you realize that space is a accumulated structural residue of a relentless rendering process, then spatial expansion isn't a mystery at all.
It's not.
It's a logical necessity. Every single rendering event happening continuously at every point in the universe is constantly adding its microscopic structural residue to the CRAM.
So it's building up.
Dark energy isn't a mysterious, invisible fluid. It is simply the outward thermodynamic pressure of all that accumulated past history. It's the pressure of the new ash pushing against the old ash as new event points crystallize.
Pushing the room outward.
It's not a magical property of an empty container. It's the dynamic signature of ash accumulating at the frontier of becoming.
It's just the exhaust pipe of reality filling up the room. And because the room is made of the exhaust, the room has to get bigger.
You've got it.
That is incredible. It demystifies it completely. But the text doesn't stop with space. It takes that same conceptual sledgehammer to how we think about mass, and specifically, the fundamental constants of nature.
The things physicists call the magic numbers.
Yes. This addresses the infamous fine-tuning problem. Why does the proton have exactly the mass it has? Why is the fine structure constant, roughly 1137?
And standard orthodox physics treats these as brute facts. They just are.
Right.
Mass is treated as an intrinsic property of an object. It's a number stored inside a noun. The electron just has mass, the way a billiard ball is inherently spherical.
It's just built that way.
But a science organized around nouns can never ask why a constant has a particular value, because it doesn't see values as the outcome of an ongoing process. It just sees them as a label printed on the side of the particle at the factory.
Right. It's like asking why a mountain is a mountain. It just is.
Yeah.
But KUT is a verb grammar. It's all about process. So how does a verb-based theory define something as heavy and solid as mass?
In KUT, mass is not an intrinsic property.
Okay.
Mass is not stuff. Mass is a geometric cost.
A cost.
It is the activation energy required to execute a specific continuous verb, and that verb is something the text calls the I turn.
The I turn, the letter I followed by turn.
Exactly.
Let's make sure we get this right, because this sounds like the core mechanics of the whole theory.
Okay.
The text says this is the topological operation by which the Abraxian engine rotates potentiality through the complex plane and precipitates actuality.
Which is a lot of big words.
Which is a lot of big words, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's ground it.
Think of the universe as a vast computational engine. The I turn is the mechanical effort required for the engine to pull something out of the chaotic realm of pure formless potential and force it into actual physical rendered existence.
Pulling it into reality.
Yes. That rotation, that processing effort, isn't free. Just like running a heavy program on your computer makes the processor hot and consumes electricity, rendering reality costs energy.
Makes sense.
And that continuous energy cost is what we measure macroscopically as mass.
Oh.
A proton is more massive than an electron, not because it has more stuff hiding inside its little container, but because its specific complex topological configuration requires far more activation energy to sustain its continuous rendering cycle.
It's the performance cost of the engine. Mm-hmm. You're paying a subscription fee of energy to keep the proton rendered, and that fee is what we call mass.
Exactly. And those magic numbers, like the fine structure constant of 1137, the one that Richard Feynman famously said every good theoretical physicist should put up on their wall and worry about.
Yeah, that one.
They aren't arbitrary dials set by some external creator. The text explicitly defines the fine structure constant as the bandwidth efficiency ratio of the Abraxian engine.
So it's an efficiency metric.
It's a performance metric. It's the ratio of the actual rendering throughput compared to the theoretical maximum. The universe isn't fine-tuned by accident. It has settled into stable attractor dynamics over billions of developmental cycles. The constants are the universe's memory of what works efficiently.
It's one thing to sit here and listen to these concepts. Space is ash, mass is an energy cost, reality is an ongoing verb. It just sounds incredibly elegant, almost like poetry.
It is beautiful.
But the text gives a massive, glaring warning right about here. It says it's entirely possible to read all this, nod along, say, oh, that's beautiful, and actually completely, utterly misunderstand it.
Because our brains will secretly, automatically ruin the translation. This is what Lynch identifies as the cognitive trap. And it is incredibly insidious because it happens subconsciously. When a mind that has been conditioned from birth by the Platonic pathogen, which is every single one of us,
oh, yeah, definitely.
Reads KUT, it automatically tries to perform a mental process called patching.
Patching. I know this term from software. It's like when your computer has a fundamentally broken, outdated operating system, but instead of wiping the hard drive and installing the new one, you just try to download a patch.
To make the new program sort of run on the old broken system?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the exact analogy. Instead of closing the rift by consciously and actively suspending our old noun architecture, we try to accommodate these new radical Noelian verbs by shoving them into our existing noun drawers.
We force them to fit.
We take a dynamic, flowing process and we quietly, secretly reupholster it with Platonic furniture. We end up with a mental model that uses all of KUT's cool new vocabulary, but gets the physical conclusions entirely backward.
And the text outlines several specific, highly common traps that readers fall into. Trap one is the subject-object error.
Yes.
And this one is massive because it deals directly with human consciousness.
Yes. And this is perhaps the most profound, deeply personal shift in the entire framework. The default Platonic reading of consciousness, the one neuroscientists and biologists use, is that consciousness is a product generated by a biological machine.
The brain.
Right. The brain is a noun, a container made of meat, and it produces consciousness as an object, the way a furnace produces heat or a liver produces bile.
Right. The brain is the subject doing the work, and my conscious experience is the object it creates. If the brain dies, the furnace turns off, the heat dissipates, and the consciousness is gone.
But in KUT, we have to reject that entirely. Consciousness is not a product. Consciousness is the instant field.
The instant field.
Yes.
The text defines this as the universal synthesizing operation happening at Planck frequency everywhere in the cosmos.
Let's break that down. The instant field is the active locus where the rendering event actually happens. It is the razor's edge where the unrendered potential of the future, the chaos field, crashes into the crystallized history of the past. The control field.
The leading edge of time.
This rendering act, this precipitation of reality, is happening everywhere at roughly 10 to the 43rd power times per second at every single microscopic event point in the cosmos.
That is fast.
It is happening in the vacuum of space. It's happening in the core of a star, and it's happening in your living room, whether a biological brain is there to witness it or not.
Wait. Are you saying consciousness is happening everywhere?
Well,
because that sounds like panpsychism. That sounds like you're saying my coffee mug is secretly thinking about being a coffee mug.
No, it's distinct from panpsychism. KUT isn't saying the coffee mug has thoughts or human-like awareness. It is saying that the fundamental operation of consciousness, the act of taking multiple potentials, synthesizing them, and collapsing them into a single defined reality, that raw base-level operation is universal. What a human brain does is act as a highly sophisticated, biologically evolved local amplifier for that underlying universal field.
An amplifier.
We are, in the text's terminology, sovereign fractal processors. We don't generate the instant field out of dead matter. We channel it. We focus it into a tight, coherent beam.
So if the brain dies,
if you remove the brain, the local, highly complex amplification disappears, but the universal rendering operation continues exactly as before. The ocean doesn't disappear just because you break the bucket you were using to hold it.
This raises an incredibly profound question, though. If consciousness isn't trapped in the biological mush of the skull, if the brain is just an antenna for a universal field, what does that mean for extreme human experiences?
It changes everything.
The text specifically brings up near-death experiences, or NDEs, to explain the physical mechanics of this.
It does, and the implications for how we view life and death are staggering. If the brain is just a local amplifier, what physically happens when that biological amplifier starts to fail?
It stops focusing the beam.
Right. In standard medical biology, an NDE, seeing the light, moving through a tunnel, experiencing the void, is dismissed as just a dying brain hallucinating due to a lack of oxygen and a flood of panic chemicals.
That's a glitch in the noun.
But in KUT, when the local rendering signal of the brain collapses, what the text calls TRC collapse, or topological resonant coherence collapse, the experiencer doesn't just turn off. They encounter the dark void.
People who have survived NDEs always talk about that void. This immense, quiet, all-encompassing blackness before the light.
In the Noelian framework, that void is not a lack of oxygen hallucination. It is the sovereign fractal processor directly encountering the raw CRAM substrate itself. Remember, the CRAM is the geometric memory underlying all space-time. The void is just the quietest, most fundamental expression of that universal substrate. It is experienced directly because the noisy, hyperactive local amplification of the biological brain has finally shut down.
The static is gone.
Yes. You are no longer projecting your reality through the manifold. You are perceiving reality from within the manifold.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this means that our individual memories, our personalities, what the text calls the CRAM, the Noelian resonant emission manifold, they aren't actually stored in the physical synapses of our brain tissue.
No, they aren't.
They are imprinted directly into the manifold underlying all of space-time.
Yes. Your brain is the stylus that writes the memory into the manifold, but the manifold is the hard drive that holds it.
That is mind-bending.
Which brings us perfectly to Trap 2. The invisible grid error. Because as soon as we talk about the CRAM acting as a hard drive holding memories, the Platonic mind immediately imagines an invisible grid.
Like graph paper.
Exactly. We picture a cosmic sheet of graph paper stretching out infinitely through empty space, just waiting for the universe to draw on it.
I have to admit, I'm completely guilty of this. Even earlier when we were talking about spaces, Ash, I was still kind of picturing an empty room and the engine was just filling up with smoke. But the room, the dimensions of the room were still there first in my mind.
That is the exact trap. You are patching the new verb onto the old noun. The CRAM does not precede the rendering process.
It doesn't exist yet.
It does not exist ahead of the Abraxian engine. It exists strictly and exclusively in the direction of the past. It only extends as far as the rendering process has already reached. It isn't a pre-existing cage that the universe inhabits. It's a structural pattern that the universe writes as it goes.
It's the difference between buying a blank journal that already has 300 physical pages bound together waiting for your ink versus a magical journal that physically only materializes the page at the exact millisecond the ink leaves your pen.
Precisely.
There are no blank pages ahead of the pen.
A beautiful analogy. There is no future grid, and that leads directly into Trap 3, the new particle error.
Oh, this one got me too.
Right. When readers encounter the fundamental unit of KUT, the node, they immediately want to file it away as a new, cooler particle.
Right, because the text calls the node a three torus knot. So, despite everything we've just learned, my brain naturally wants to picture a tiny, static, pretzel-shaped physical object floating around in the vacuum.
But the node isn't a static object. It is a continuous topological engine. It is dynamically locked in a braid. The designation of a three torus knot isn't describing the node's shape, the way a ball is round, it is describing the node's mathematical activity.
Its flow.
Yes, it's a continuous flow. The control field flowing out is past history, the chaos field flowing in is future potential, and the rendering executing at the nexus points of the knot.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. If the node isn't a particle, but a process, it's like we've been looking at a whirlpool in a river and trying to weigh it and measure it like it's a solid gray rock. The shape of a whirlpool is entirely defined by its activity. If the spinning stops, the whirlpool doesn't just sit there quietly. It ceases to exist entirely. It blends back into the river.
That is the core insight. A whirlpool is a verb. And if you ask a physicist, what is the rest mass of this whirlpool, you are asking a mathematically malformed question. It's a category error.
You can't weigh a verb.
The mass of the node is precisely the activation energy of its continuous spinning. If the node stops spinning, it doesn't leave a dead node corpse behind. It has no mass because it doesn't exist. Its mass and its existence are the exact same ongoing action.
So if our brains are so deeply hardwired by our language, by centuries of physics, by thousands of years of Western philosophy, to naturally fall into these traps.
And they are.
If we desperately want to turn the whirlpool into a rock and the written page into a pre-existing blank book, how do we actively fight back? How can anyone read this theory and actually understand it without immediately misinterpreting it?
Well, the author, Lynch, anticipates this exact problem.
Thank goodness.
The source text provides what it calls a firewall. It is a set of four operational protocols that you must actively, consciously maintain in your mind to read reality correctly. You have to run these protocols in the background of your thoughts constantly.
Let's run through them, because I need the firewall.
Yeah.
Protocol one is the ontological grammar shift.
This is the master protocol, the foundation of the firewall. It demands that we consciously, forcefully reject the question, what is it made of? And replace it entirely with, how does it happen?
That's tough to do all the time.
It takes practice. Whenever you encounter a noun in your mind while reading KUT, you must aggressively translate it into a verb. Don't say a particle has mass. Say a node incurs the geometric cost of the faraturn.
Okay.
Don't say space exists between the planets. Say rendering events have accumulated sediment between these active loci.
It sounds utterly exhausting, I'm not going to lie. It's like learning to speak a foreign language by forcing yourself to stop translating it back into English in your head.
That's exactly what it is.
You have to start dreaming in the new language.
It is exactly like that. You are learning the language of becoming. And it requires immense cognitive discipline until it becomes natural.
Protocol two is where things get genuinely psychedelic. It's the thermodynamic phasing of time.
Yes.
And this one is wild because we have to abandon the linear timeline completely.
Yeah.
The timeline we all learn in grade school, past, present, future, as doth on a line, is just thrown out the window.
The linear timeline is an illusion born of the Platonic pathogen. Time in KUT is not a spatial line you walk down. Time has three ontologically distinct thermodynamic phases.
Like phases matter.
Think of the phases of water. Solid ice, liquid water, and gaseous steam. Time operates the exact same way.
Okay, let's break this down phase by phase. What is the past?
The past is solid. It is the control field. It's completely crystallized, saturated, and thermodynamically irreversible.
Because it already happened.
It has 0 degrees of freedom left because the act of rendering has locked its geometry in permanently. It is the cram. And just like a growing ice crystal exerts immense physical pressure on its surrounding medium, this solid past presses outward at the speed of light.
Wait.
That outward thermodynamic pressure of the solidifying past is what we currently misidentify as dark energy.
Dark energy is just the physical pressure of the solid past expanding. Okay, if the past is solid ice, what about the future?
The future is gas. It is the chaos field. It is pure, unrendered potentiality. It is maximally disordered, fluid, with no definite geometric configuration until a rendering event actively selects one and locks it in.
Steam.
Yes, steam. And what do massive, dense clouds of gas do in cosmology? They exert an inward gravitational pull.
Oh my God.
That pull, the immense gravitational weight of unrendered potentiality pressing inward on our rendered reality, is what orthodox physics misidentifies as dark matter.
My mind is absolutely blown by this. Dark matter isn't some invisible ghost particle that we just can't find in our colliders.
Yeah.
It's literally the gravitational weight of all that unrendered future steam pressing down on us.
It is.
The future is pulling on the present.
Precisely. It's the pressure of the unrendered waiting to be processed. And that brings us finally to the present, the instant.
The liquid phase.
It is the liquid phase boundary. The text calls it the eperon. It's not a microscopic slice of time moving along a line. It is the highly active, physically turbulent phase boundary where the gas of the future condenses and freezes into the solid of the past.
Where steam becomes ice.
It is the exact site of the epitarn.
So time isn't a line we walk along. The past is ice, the future is steam. And the present moment, the moment you and I are experiencing right now as we speak, is the exact highly energetic boundary where the steam is violently freezing into ice. And the act of freezing is reality itself.
That is the essence of Noellian ternary time. Which leads us to protocol three, math as mechanics. If we are going to understand this engine, we have to stop reading mathematical equations as static, abstract relationships between inert quantities and start reading them as literal operational manuals for topological engines.
The text uses Euler's identity to explain this, which is brilliant, because Euler's identity is famous. It's dV to the power of pi pi plus 1 equals 0, or 1 plus 1 equals 0.
The most beautiful equation in math, they call it.
Right. In standard math classes, this is taught as this beautiful, almost mystical coincidence that connects all the most important mathematical constants into one neat little package.
But KUT completely rewrites this.
It looks at it not as abstract poetry, but as a literal mechanical description of the universe's rendering loop.
This raises a profoundly important question that philosophers have argued about for centuries.
Yep.
What if mathematics isn't just an abstract art form that human minds invented, but the literal physical engineering blueprint of the cosmos?
Well, let's walk through how KUT reads the mechanics of Euler's identity. Take Euler's identity. It's usually taught as this abstract mathematical poetry. But you're saying KUT reads it like an instruction manual. If I'm looking at TK, the base rate, what is it actually doing in a physical sense in this engine?
Well, ETA is not just an abstract transcendental number. It physically represents the exponential compounding base rate of the rendering process itself.
So this is the speed of the engine.
The universe doesn't accumulate its history linearly one block at a time. It compounds its complexity exponentially, building upon its previous states. The engine accelerates based on its own output.
And then it is modified by the exponent.
Yeah.
Ete, what is he tied to doing mechanically?
Ete, the imaginary unit, represents the A-turn we discussed earlier. It is the exact mechanical topological operator that reaches into the chaos field and rotates imaginary potential into real measurable actuality.
The crank turning.
It's a literal 90-degree rotation in the complex plane of the engine's phase space.
And
Tai Pi represents the topological phase cost of one complete rendering cycle. It's the angle through which the field must physically rotate to fully convert one quantum of potential into one quantum of history.
So E's Pi is the engine turning over one time.
Yes.
And then we have the plus one E will kind one. How is that mechanics?
That represents the thermodynamic accounting of the engine. The Tai plus eta 1 is the initial quantum of potential fed into the system.
And the zero.
The entire equation reads operationally like this. The exponential rendering process, executing one iota turn rotation through a full phase cycle, operating on one unit of potential, perfectly and completely exhausts that potential, leaving exactly zero unrendered potential remaining in that specific transaction. Balance is achieved.
It's an engine specification.
It is.
It's not a math trick. It's a schematic for a thermodynamic cycle.
It is the blueprint of becoming.
Wow.
And finally, we have protocol 4, the principle of irreducible extent. To keep the firewall active, we must fiercely reject the concept of zero volume entirely.
Now the pixel size again?
We must anchor our mental model in the 1x1x1 node minimum. The universe has a fundamental resolution. It has a pixel size operating at the Planck scale.
No more dimensionless points.
Yeah.
Reality actually takes up space because it is the creation of space.
Yes. And because reality operates on a finite bandwidth, strictly constrained by the speed of light, not everything can be rendered instantly.
Right.
The universe is bounded. There are no actual infinities in nature, only processes that approach a boundary they can never cross.
So let's step back and look at the whole picture. If we successfully apply this firewall,
Which takes work,
yes.
Yeah.
If we shift our grammar from nouns to verbs, if we understand time as thermodynamic phases of ice and steam,
mm-hmm.
if we read math as physical mechanics, and if we reject zero volume, we are looking at a universe that is a massive compounding rendering engine.
Yes, we are.
But where do we fit into the machine? Are we just cogs?
This is where the deep dive comes directly home to you, the listener. The text concludes with a radical, almost spiritual recontextualization of the observer. The universe, KUT says, is a collection of events with histories compounding exponentially.
And this engine has been running for something like 10 to the 60th power rendering cycles.
Yes. 10 cycles of the cram, deepening its attractor values, reinforcing stable patterns, learning what structural forms work and what forms collapse.
Learning.
The universe isn't fine-tuned by accident. It is educated. It has learned how to render complex biological structures over billions of years of iterative processing.
And we are the apex of that learning process. The text calls us sovereign fractal processors. We are highly coherent, self-amplifying concentrations of the instant field. We are the engine running hot.
Think about what that means structurally for your own life.
Yeah.
You listening to this deep dive right now, you are not an outside observer studying a scientific theory through a telescope.
Yeah.
You are a local expression of the very process the theory is describing.
We are the universe.
Your act of understanding this material, the physical neurons firing in your brain, the concepts locking into place in your memory, that is literally the steam of the chaos field converting into the ice of the control field, one event point at a time.
So what does this all mean? It means the mirror that science has been looking through for 2,500 years was never a window to an outside world.
No, it wasn't.
The performance and the performer are the exact same thing.
We are the universe witnessing itself in the act of becoming.
It's like the universe is a massive, incredibly complex, compounding symphony. But instead of us sitting passively in the audience listening to it, we are a complex loop of notes within the song that suddenly became self-aware enough to read the sheet music. We are the music listening to itself.
And we have always been playing. The music never stops. It only evolves.
We've traveled incredibly far today. We started by diagnosing a 2,500-year-old grammatical disease, the Platonic pathogen.
We tore it down.
We tore down the mathematical hallucinations of singularities and division by zero. We reimagined space not as an empty container, but as the ash of a structural fire.
We reimagined time.
Yes, not as a line, but as thermodynamic phases of past ice, future steam, and the violent freezing moment of the present in between. All to realize that reality is fundamentally, unequivocally, a verb.
We have traded the static ontology of being for the dynamic ontology of becoming.
And that leaves us with a final thought to mull over as you go back to your day. If your consciousness is quite literally the highly amplified leading edge of the universe, rendering future potential into solid history, what responsibility does that give you for the steam you choose to freeze into ice tomorrow?
What are you rendering?
If you are the universe's way of writing its own permanent memory into the manifold, what exactly are you choosing to write right now? Keep questioning your nouns.